This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, this is Kate Tenenbaum with the Saturday Evening Post, reading from the March-April issue and picking up on the Franklin Delano Roosevelt article. Last week, we were following his political journey and had learned that he had then contracted polio. Let's pick up from where we left off. His moment had come in 1928 when he surprised the New York political scene with a last-minute candidacy for the state's governorship, then shocked the nation with a decisive win. He had leveraged a strong performance in that office to wage a successful campaign to be his party's 1932 presidential nominee. In November of that year, he defeated the reviled incumbent Republican president Herbert Hoover in a landslide. Franklin had assumed the presidency in March of 1933, the darkest hour of the Great Depression. One in four adults was out of work. The nation's financial system was on the brink of collapse, and the republic itself seemed in moral danger. But beginning with the extraordinary legislative activities of his first 100 days, he had reinvented the role of the federal government and remade much of American life with the sweeping programs of the New Deal. By the summer of 1936, he was already thought to be the most significant American president since Abraham Lincoln. Most important, though, millions of Americans remained hungry and out of work. Franklin's energy and magnetic charisma in office had transformed the country's spirits. The previous day, the Democrats gathered in Philadelphia had rapturously nominated him for 4 more years in the White House. At 10 o'clock that night, he would accept the nomination in front of the crowd of 100,000 in a speech broadcast over the radio nationwide. As Franklin's cars moved slowly across the field, an excited voice on the loudspeaker announced his arrival. The faces in the crowd strained for a glimpse of him, but most saw nothing. That was all right by Franklin. On that long-ago day in San Francisco in 1920, he had to scheme about ways to get people to look at him. Now, his challenge was the opposite, making sure people didn't see too much. Despite his efforts, he had never regained his ability to walk. In private, he moved about most comfortably in a dining chair that had been refashioned as a wheelchair. At times, when he'd needed to move somewhere quickly, he had been known to drop to the floor and crawl across the room. He could, with some practice, move around on crutches, placing one crutch in front of him, pivoting his weight at the hips so that his legs swung out in front of him. But without a companion's arm to steady him, his progress was ungainly and fraught with peril. When he returned to an active political life, Franklin's great fear had been falling in front of an audience. Over the years, he had been carried up countless sets of stairs, had been pushed through the window of a train compartment, had been dangled down onto a stage from a fire escape. Whatever it took to avoid being jostled, losing control, falling to the ground. The car came to a stop when it reached the back of the platform. Franklin had long since perfected a method for exiting an automobile. Swiveling his torso to the side, he would extend his arms up, waiting for a pair of strong hands to pull and lift him out of the car. Outside the vehicle, he would steady himself, taking the arm of whoever was tasked with supporting him. Tonight, as on many nights, that person was James Jimmy Roosevelt, Franklin's 28-year-old eldest son. At the back of the convention speaker's platform, he took hold of Jimmy's arm with one hand. In his other hand, he held a cane he used to help steady his weight. On the platform, a large group of dignitaries and party leaders swarmed towards him. Among them was Edwin Markham, the 84-year-old Dean of American Poetry, who had just finished reciting a poem he'd composed for the occasion, Franklin D. Roosevelt, Man of Destiny. White-bearded, with large expressive eyes, the aged poet approached Franklin to say hello. As he drew near, however, Markham was jostled by the crowd and lost his footing. Falling forward, he struck Jimmy Roosevelt, who in turn lost his own footing and fell into his father. Absorbing the blow, the steel brace on Franklin's right leg gave way. Franklin struggled to regain his balance, but his body crumpled. As he fell headfirst towards the floor of the platform, the pages of the speech he was about to deliver scattered in the air. Seeing the president slip, a Secret Service agent dove forward to catch him. Just before Franklin touched the ground, the agent thrust his shoulder under Franklin's armpit, arresting his fall and scooping him up. James A. Farley, Franklin's political advisor, who was now serving as chairman of the Democratic Party, quickly led a group of other officials in forming a tight circle around Franklin. They knew, without being told what to do in Franklin's moment of exposed vulnerability, don't let people see. Within their shelter, Franklin's heart raced. He had fallen before, but never in so public a setting. He could hear the roar of 100,000 waiting for him, watching for him. Don't let them see. Meanwhile, Franklin's attendants held him in the air and refastened his brace. Clean me up, Franklin commanded. He was anxious and agitated. Seeing his pages strewn all about, he barked orders about those damn sheets. There wasn't time to prepare a clean copy of the remarks. A radio broadcast was set to begin in mere moments. A chaotic scene followed. People dusting him off, chasing after stray pages. Okay, he finally announced when all the sheets had been recovered. Let's go. But as he and Jimmy resumed their progress, Franklin caught sight of Edwin Markham a few feet away, weeping over all the trouble his stumble had caused. On Jimmy's arm, Franklin went over to the old man, took him by the hand, and offered a reassuring smile. All would be well. Soon, he was at the speaker's stand, smiling broadly as the crowd cheered him. Then, with stagey exaggeration, he looked at his watch to remind his audience of the impending broadcast and signaled for them to hush. Just after 10 o'clock, he began to speak. The speech he gave that night in Philadelphia would be one of his most celebrated. In it, he sought to provide context for the work his administration had done over the previous 3.5 years to save the country from ruin. Yet Franklin knew that for many listening to his words, his presidency was something greater than just restoring the country's economic health. In his first term, he told them, he'd sought to renew the nation's spiritual purpose, to replace the pursuit of narrow self-interest with a more nourishing generosity and concern for humankind. In the place of the palace of privilege, we seek to build a temple out of faith and hope and charity. As he concluded his remarks that night, he spoke of destiny. There is a mysterious cycle in human events. This generation of Americans has a rendezvous with destiny. Destiny was indeed a mysterious thing. Franklin Roosevelt had learned that long ago. As a young man, cosseted in his own palace of privilege, he had believed himself destined for glory. He had thought that if he followed a straightforward path from success to success, greatness would surely come. Then, one awful day, illness had surprised him, mocked his certainty, and tossed his expectations of triumph aside. But that stroke of fate that had turned his legs lifeless had also made him the man who could inspire and lead his country that night. Polio had remade his life, created a more gifted, intuitive, compassionate politician, made him a better man. It had taught him the one thing that his country needed most, how to find hope in the darkness and how to share it with the world. Jonathan Darman is a journalist and historian who writes about American politics and the presidency. He is the author of Landslide, LBJ and Ronald Reagan at the Dawn of the New America. Fiction, Vagaries by Christy Cockrell. Dinah was on a dogged hunt for Aunt Jane's recipe for puree Leontine. The day was sodden gray, as the past several weeks had been, and she had her heart set on the green soup, the concoction, wonderful word, of spring-like things that always raised her spirits. Green peas and lettuce, spinach, leeks, parsley, and mint. She had exhausted the cookbook shelves, checking inside each book in turn and there, finding old tickets for Midsummer Mozart, and a flyer for an exhibition of Leonardo da Vinci's drawings at the Legion of Honor in 2008, as well as a pressed petunia that had lost its deep indigo color and half its petals. Then she remembered she'd struck some handwritten recipes into her battered copy of Mrs. Beaton's book of household management in the alcove between the kitchen and bathroom. On her way to find it, she stopped dead in her tracks, transfixed by the red Christmas cactus in wholehearted gladsome bloom. Transfixed was not a word Dinah used lightly, or actually at all, but it was a word Sally Larkin, her seventh-grade art teacher, had used one snow-muted morning about a painting she showed them of a rhapsodic Saint Sebastian nude against a marble pillar in one of the big glossy art books she propped upright on the old wooden drafting cabinet between a coffin can of paintbrushes and an archaic terracotta goddess with her features blurred in a way Dinah so identified with, even all those years later, seeing herself as oddly blurred as well. The fact that the cactus was blooming at the end of February, not at Christmas, did nothing to diminish her delight at its beauty, at the joyful fulfillment, and much more, of its plantly mission. Its sense of time had always been a little off since it was no more than a baby shoot. She remembered the chilly Christmas Eve she'd carried it home in a jam jar, swaddled in her gray striped scarf and gently tucked into her deep winter coat. Unmarried then, she'd eaten good New Mexican pozole spiced with chili pods and cumin and oregano with Edna Avery, who once taught Dinah piano. The persistent tardiness of the cactus had endeared it to her, a fellow tardy soul, besides its being Edna who had given the cutting to her. Grown up, Dinah marveled that her teachers, wise and adult, should want to be friends with her once they were no longer obliged to ask her to try those triads one more time, dear, or not to use so many exclamation marks in her An American History compositions. That they regarded her on some kind of equal footing made her grateful and proud. And when her daughters Becky and Abby reached school age and then college, their teachers, as often as not younger than Dinah, had called her Mrs. Farquhar and talked to her with respect. Even those who taught tricky things like calculus, physics, computer this and that. One, Theo Ruskin, a kindly old professor of Portuguese, which Abby needed to complete her paleobotany project in Brazil, had admired her Grudren Sudgen forest patchwork dress and told her she might like to take the fabric printing class at Cabrillo College from his neighbor Eileen, who had a good eye, too, for fun clothes. Dinah had rescued the cactus in the move to Santa Cruz the year before last after Dorian, her attorney husband, had left her for his acupuncturist, Sapphire, an energetic and decisive woman with two haughty French poodles. While she was packing and preparing for a new life in a new house in an unfamiliar town, she'd been pushed by friends to get rid of most of her things, which she saw as the harvest of the years. She felt hounded even by Becky and Abby since those books started appearing everywhere, insisting, "You must clear your clutter now, or go straight to the hell of hoarders." A place that would, she imagined, look like one of those coastal antique stores where you can't turn sideways without dislodging a troop of starry, glassy-eyed dolls, one of those hideous Art Deco clocks, often lime green, or a scaly old taxidermy crocodile. She'd very carefully taken a cutting of the new matronly cactus with her, as she'd done from Edna's all those Christmases ago. She'd kept it in a jar of water on one of her new living room windowsills for the best part of a year, letting its root get long and tangled, fine as corn silk, before transplanting it into a pretty pot she'd found that would be perfect for it, Tavandera blue ceramic. Dinah didn't believe in letting too much go. Well, much of anything, really. The moving van had been quite full. She subscribed to the theories of a writer from the Santa Clara Pueblo, whose articles she'd been given in a pottery class in the early 90s, and had found again recently when looking for the program from The Lion King in her desk. The writer, T. Tessie Naranjo said the Pueblo dwellers visited the ruins of the Mesa, where their ancestors had lived, to find the remnants of their things the old ones had had around them every day. We visit and revisit our ancestral homes to connect with the past and with the spirits of those who have passed on. Prayerfully, silently, we thank those spirits that, in their quiet way, welcome us to their place. If the day is good, if an extra nice pottery piece is found, it tells us that we have been living right, that we are remembered and are one with our ancestors. The things Dinah collected were what she had left of people she had loved, people who'd given her whatever definition she might have. Her parents, Sally Larkin, Edna Avery, Aunt Jane, her mother's Faye sister who wore moonstones for healing energy and made brilliant green soup, which made Dinah remember the recipe, and this time get as far as Mrs. Beaton, another old friend. She wanted the soup for her Wednesday dinner with Becky, who would be full of news about her startup company for eco-friendly body care and distracted throughout the incoming text messages, but Dinah's recipe for parenting had always been to try to show the girls delight. Color-drenched picture books, Partridge Farm goldfish in tomato soup, cinnamon pumpkin bath fizz after full days snowboarding at Tahoe, ruby-throated hummingbirds, luminous dingy as Dinah saw them, drinking from salvias in the garden. Her daughters humored her in turn, in an exasperated way. She always felt muddled, out of breath, and not quite sure of anything, but happy to be told, and happy just to be in the same room with them, watching them text, admiring the gleam of lamplight on Abby's blue, highlighted hair, wondering if Becky wouldn't like some of the cute ankle-wrap espadrilles out of the J. Jill catalog to wear to the opening of her boyfriend's Asian Fusion Taco Bar in Capitola. "Mother," her older daughter protested in that put-upon voice, rejecting her suggestions outright, always one of the sure ones. How had she come by that? Dinah often wondered, proud and bewildered. Becky, too, when she herself had always been so vague. She felt a tug in one pocket of her terrycloth bathrobe and pulled out the little Roman spoon, its bowl generally engraved with a panther, which Abby had brought as a careless souvenir from her July dig in Hadrian's Wall last year. Dinah had spotted it yesterday morning while putting away Queen's silverware, and with a small cry of delight, had taken it out of the drawer, where it had been tucked after the move. She'd been distracted at some point and left it in her pocket. So there was the Roman spoon. But where, oh where, the recipe? Sometimes, like now, her imprecision rather worried her. Her thinking things would turn up when they didn't. But when poor sainted Dorian had called her ditzy every time he growled at her distractions and her dithering, the bright arrows that pierced her heart and left her stuck still, wondering, arrows as mystical as those the Renaissance painter stuck into the nude Saint Sebastian, Dinah had never felt particularly martyred. It didn't bother her. She'd, after all, agreed with him and thought it was just fine. "We're worried about you," Becky said, when they came by unexpectedly with takeout from Falfella late Saturday afternoon. "You seem at loose ends." "Rather lost," Abby added, looking up from a field, a report she'd brought along to edit between bites of pita bread dipped in hummus. "Poor Mammy. It's no wonder, of course, considering all the baloney this past year with Dad and Poodle Lady, or Our Lady of the Poodles, as Becky called Sapphire, the acupuncturist neither girl liked, no matter that their father had long since moved into her sleek townhouse at Pleasure Point and commuted without complaining over Highway 17 twice every day. Dinah was bewildered by their concern. When hadn't she been at loose ends? So much better at loose ends, surely, than bandied about by poodles. She'd have no idea how to take care of such silly, condescending dogs, always looking down those haughty noses at you. But still, she didn't want them thinking she wasn't okay. She worried for days over their worrying, always hating to cause any fuss or trouble. And she was disappointed, too, at never having found the recipe from Aunt Jane. She had to serve Becky a rather tedious vegetable soup instead. Not at all what she had in mind. She'd take a glass, Dinah decided. They wouldn't see the point, of course. She couldn't paint or even make a simple pencil sketch look anything like it ought to, despite Shirley Larkin's kindest efforts those years ago. Couldn't remember how to fumble through Fleur Elise on the piano she'd given to a neighbor with small children when leaving Menlo Park. However patient Edna Avery had been, setting her metronome, giving her Mexican hot chocolate with chile and orange after that awful recital to cheer her up. She'd never learned to make pots or even funky loop-sided bowls. She couldn't even have learned acupuncture, and why in the world would she want to? But she did so enjoy studying things, collecting bits from here and there and weaving all of them into her varied colored life, like a bird's nest or one of those crocheted coral reefs. Nothing ever lost, really, just momentarily misplaced. Was it fair to call the gatherings of mementos clutter? To say it had to go? She looked up sewing and fiber art classes in the Cabrillo College catalog she had picked up outside the market and found what looked like one of Abby's professors had mentioned. Fabric painting sounded like good fun, and having a project like that might keep the girls from thinking their mother too ditzy to pick herself up and move forward. At the end of the first class, when she was walking to her car, parked somewhere along here, she knew, and humming a John Denver song from the cassette Dorian had thrown away shortly after they married, and she had to buy again when CDs came along, looking up at the lovely, welcome winter sunlight through the eucalyptus trees, instead of where she was going, she barreled into somebody coming the other way, his nose down in a paperback. He looked up, startled, steadied her. Dinah backed off, apologized. "I'm always doing that, my daughter Abby says." The big man with a baggy heather fisherman's sweater and amiable craggy eyebrows laughed and looked at her more closely. "Abby? Not Abby Farquhar." "Yes. Why? How do you know?" "I didn't recognize you in those ordinary clothes." Theo Ruskin remembered Dinah's papagini plumage, the brilliant colored dress, the bright aura she cast the gloomy afternoon she came by with Abby to pick up one of Jose Saramago's novels from his Stark office in the language department. They talked some more and laughed at the coincidence of their meeting, both lost in wayward thoughts, and Dinah told him of the cloth she'd stenciled with petroglyph suns in shades of parakeet and mint and seafoam, guided by his friend Eileen, the textile artist whom he'd come by chance to drive back to Soquel after his day prowling used bookstores in Pacific Grove and Monterey. And when they became friends, and more, and were married at Sandrock Farm in Aptos, where the Grateful Dead were said to have jammed with Santana and an old barn in the 60s, what Theo loved most about Dinah, always, was the brightness she carried with her. Sometimes a Roman spoon, sometimes a vivid violet Crayola for jotting down shopping lists, sometimes a bowl of fragrant, bright green soup she often made on gray days from a family recipe, which had turned up inexplicably inside a tattered old tortilla warmer in a cupboard by the sink the evening of the day Dinah had almost run him down, he'd tell people, laughing with his kind, rumbly chuckle. The day she'd hit him like a feather-fetched arrow, sharp and decisive, piercing him straight through. Christy B. Cockrell's work has been published by Catamaran Literary Readers, Tin House, and New Letters, among others. She recently published a volume of collected poems, Contagious Magic. Vagaries was first published in Catamaran Literary Reader, catamaranliteraryreader.com. See your story published here. The 2025 Great American Fiction Contest is now underway. One winner will receive $1,000 in publication in the magazine, and five runners-up will win $200 and a publication online. To enter, visit SaturdayEveningPost.com/fiction-contest. Your health. Smart ideas from leading experts in medicine. Plant power. Doctors and researchers have long touted the benefits of spending time outdoors. With household plants, you can bring some of those benefits indoors, too. According to research, houseplants can be beneficial for your health in several ways. Reduce stress and anxiety. Interacting with plants has been proven to have a calming effect that reduces blood pressure, heart rate, and the body's levels of the stress hormone cortisol. Increase productivity. Studies show that students and employees working near houseplants experience psychological benefits that improve concentration and memory. Improve air quality. NASA researchers found that common houseplants could remove as much as 90% of certain toxins from the air in just 24 hours, creating a healthier indoor environment. What houseplants should you get? Laura Matter, a program manager at gardening nonprofit Tilth Alliance, suggests that tropical shade plants like peace lilies and philodendrons do best indoors, while English ivies and spider plants are best for improving air quality. Your Health Medical Mailbox, founded by Corey Service, MD. Joint Understanding. What are bone spurs and how do I treat them? Sarah Madura, Westchester, New York. Osteophytes, more commonly called bone spurs, are bony growths that generally develop near joints, typically around the spine, knees, hands, and feet. They can exert pressure on nearby nerves and joints and cause a lot of discomfort, usually in the form of stiffness, pain, and limited motion. Bone spurs are surprisingly common. About 40% of people over 60 develop them. They can be brought on by quite a few conditions. Bone spurs can be hereditary, but can also spring from joint injuries caused by everything from sports to falls to car accidents. Arthritis and bad posture can be causes too, and so can poor nutrition. However, taking calcium supplements doesn't promote bone spur growth, as the spurs are caused by inflammation. The best way to safeguard against bone spurs are regular movement like walking and stretching, eating right, and practicing good posture. One particularly nagging variety of bone spurs is the heel spur, a bone spur that protrudes from your heel. One way you can preemptively avoid the inflammation that causes heel spurs is to wear shoes that support the arches of your feet, or else add arch-supporting orthotic insoles. These can also prevent other foot problems like plantar fasciitis or bunions. You should also wear shoes or slippers on tile or hardwood floors. And, as always, maintaining a healthy weight is good for your feet. Like their causes, the symptoms of bone spurs come in a variety of flavors. Muscle cramps and spasms, burning or tingling in extremities, dull neck or back pain, and radiating pain in areas like the shoulders, buttocks, and thighs can all signal the presence of bone spurs. If you're experiencing these symptoms, it's best to consult your physician. Fortunately, a number of different tests like x-rays, MRIs, and tomography scans can reveal the existence of spurs. Bone spurs can be a problem, but they're one that can be solved. While some are more serious, cases require surgery, the growths are often successfully treated with steroid shots or non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, physical therapy, and simple rest. Until bone spurs are successfully treated, it's best to curtail more strenuous physical activity. That's all the time we have for today. This has been Kate Tenenbaum with the Saturday Evening Post. Good night.